Welcome to the Swamp Flicks podcast. My name is Brandon Lede.
And I'm Brittany Lomboss.
And we are recording in Brittany's new living room in Faubourg St. John. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
We're close to the bayou. You walk there from here.
Yeah.
This is Studio C now.
Studio C. I know. Now I have a living situation where it's not like a room, so I can actually like sit down with other people other than my like dog and my cat. So
wonderful.
This is Studio C. Hello. Yeah.
Hi. Good to see you. I want to announce something ahead of time because I feel like I'm always doing this after the fact, but
like the little teaser at the end,
right?
Let's put it in the beginning.
Well, next week Overlook Film Fest is going to be in New Orleans.
Yep.
So the week after Easter, go to either location of the Britannia and you'll see a bunch of great horror movies. I think it's like the best film festival in town and I'm always looking forward to it.
I've never been to it, but I plan on like, I would love to see just something like, of course, there's a few films where I'm like, oh, like, I want to see this, this and this. But I think I'm kind of switching my method to being, if you have like 5 hours available, just fucking go and experience it.
Right.
Who cares what's playing? Like, I'm sure it's going to be fabulous. Like, there's not one film that was listed that looked like, oh, I don't think I would enjoy that. I think they're all, even like a lot of the re-releases, too.
Yeah, they're really well curated.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the re-releases are this year. Now they're doing The Beyond.
The Beyond.
The Fulci movie.
Yeah. I would love to see that in theaters.
They're doing a 3D screening of Creature from the Black Lagoon,
yes.
Which yeah. I saw in 3D at Chalmette Movies back in the day, and it was beautiful.
Wasn't Chalmette Movies such a wonderful little gem? They always had the coolest stuff playing. Like, I feel like the Britannia Theater would do like the cool midnight movies and stuff like
yeah.
that, but the only other theater in town, kind of in town, was the Chalmette Movies.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of stuff there that was playing nowhere else.
I could
else.
See a yeah. Creature of the Black Lagoon there.
I guess Zeitgeist is holding that down now, where it's like they have movies that play nowhere else in the city, but you have to make like a long trek out to
it's
get
like
there.
Araby that they're yeah. at. Yeah. I forgot about them.
I don't go very often.
Yeah.
They do have the People's Joker coming up soon, which I've been wanting to see for
Ooh,
years.
Cool.
So maybe.
Yeah. That'd be a fun trek.
If you do see us at Overlook Film Festival and you recognize the sounds of our voices as we're chatting in line, you can say hello to us. I'm pretty a nervous fella. I might have a hard time communicating with a stranger, but it's
I would
worth
probably
it.
Like just talk about a bunch of dumb stuff and then get you off track into where you're like, I don't want to talk to you anymore. I want to leave.
That's what podcasting's all about.
Yeah.
Just inanely chatting until people are just sick of you.
Yeah.
Well, what else is going on? We threw this episode together pretty quickly. Because we had some scheduling conflicts.
Right.
I'm going to try to describe the topic, even though it's just two movies.
Yeah.
And I think you originally pitched it as like movies where people are mismatched.
Yeah, like kind of mixed match couples. But like, you're right. Because I'm like, man, that could be like a million. There's
yeah.
like so many movies and it's worth a broader thing where me, you, and Hannah and James could all make
yeah.
a selection for that.
So we narrowed it down a little bit. And I think this is what we got. Movies where somebody is attracted to Nick Cage, even though he's
yes.
from the wrong side of the tracks. And also, they're like about these communities that have very specific vernacular and cultures.
Yes. And he's like in the heart of all of it.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, the films that we're going to talk about showcase like how good he is like getting into character in those particular communities.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going East Coast to West Coast with this.
It's true.
And he does a great job in both. But what I'm pumped about is like, maybe last year there was a Nick Cage as a heartthrob topic.
Yes.
And there were four movies that we all watched. For some reason, I couldn't make it.
You were out of town or something.
Something stupid happened. And I remember being like, oh man, there's so much I wanted to say about all of these and him as like a heartthrob character. So this is sort of like a part two where I get to chime in a little bit.
It's a good addendum
so I'm excited.
To that conversation, too, because every time it comes up where it's like, Nick Cage used to be a heartthrob and like a sex symbol.
Yeah.
These are the two movies that come to mind to me where it's like, this is him at his absolute hottest.
Yeah.
This is him like at the most handsome and charming he's ever been.
Yeah. And it's before he fixed his teeth.
Yeah. Oh, he's got the beautifully fucked up teeth.
Yeah. But
movies.
That's what gave him the charm, I
yeah.
think.
Well, what else have you been watching besides Nick Cage being sexy?
Well, I watched this really interesting British film from 1988. It's based on a novel as well. It's called A Handful of Dust. It stars Kristin Scott Thomas, she's pretty wonderful in like every film I've seen her in. It's this film about these sort of aristocrats that have this massive countryside house, and it's a couple, but there's sort of this pain in the ass guy that like lives in London who's not as upper crust as them, and he sort of comes over to visit because I guess that was a normal thing, like, oh yeah, let me tell you about this mansion I have out in the countryside, you should come over and spend the weekend. And he comes over, and like the husband and wife that live in this like sort of mansion are like, oh yeah, ugh, how terrible is he, like, oh, this man's so ridiculous, blah blah blah, we'll just put him on in the room in our, you know, giant estate with the most uncomfortable bed so he never comes back. And his name's like John Beaver. That's like the one name I remember because it was so bizarre. Mr. Beaver. So he comes by train from London, and like he and the wife start to kind of have this like connection. Here's why this movie is so good. Okay. It is cheesy because there's supposed to be this sexual connection between like the aristocratic wife and then this like, you know, common guy from London.
A mismatched couple.
But the way that she acts is like she's on of like a volume the whole time, and like you can't really see her, like she doesn't express like lust or any kind of like really big emotion to where you'd be like, God, she's passionately in love with this man. It's just very like, oh yeah, it's fun. Oh, I think I should get an apartment in the city. Ooh, I got an apartment in the city so I can have this, continue this affair. And oh, London is so much more fun than this like shitty gigantic mansion that I have with my boring husband and my boring child. So it's one of those where she's kind of got the best of both worlds. And then tragedy strikes the family back at the mansion. And like her world starts to kind of fall apart and crumble. I liked it a lot.
Okay.
Like, don't go in expecting like this big, like Downton Abbey, you know, passionate acting, I guess. It's a little cheesy and the ending is very bizarre. I don't want to spoil it, but I don't know. I might talk to you in private about it later, okay. Brandon, because I feel like you would, it's just insane. But the ending is in the jungle. So you go, right. You end up in a jungle. With a remote community. So if you can figure out how you get there, I think it's worth watching.
This sounds thoroughly British. Like, the like sort of buttoned up emotions, so they're not really like acting passionately. And then, yeah, some imperialist jungle adventurism towards the end.
Yeah. And also, John Beaver's mother, he lives with his mom, Miss Beaver. Judy Dench.
There you go.
Dame Judy Dench. Yeah. I mean, come on.
It either had to be her or Maggie Smith. Those were like the two options.
That's where you get like your, oh, now it's British, right?
Right.
So I don't know. I really enjoyed it. Also, I watched, it's on Peacock now, I watched Lisa Frankenstein last night.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think of that?
I liked it. I thought it was cute. It was more entertaining than I thought it was going to be. Like, I thought it was going to be a let me try hard to be a movie about the weird girl.
Yeah.
Which those always annoy me. But, I don't know. It was cute. It was comical. It was did not take itself seriously, which I really liked. I laughed at a couple of parts. It was fine.
It's got that Diablo Cody kind of like writing where there's a lot of catchphrases and everything's kind of overwritten in that, yeah, in that Valley Girl dialect. Yes.
Yeah.
I liked it too. I felt like it could have been funnier. I don't know. There's something about the timing of the jokes where it's like, I know those words are funny in that order, but for some reason, I just wasn't laughing at the way it was delivered. Like, the rhythm of it was off.
Yes. Yes. I couldn't figure it out where I'm like, what is, like, missing? And I'm like, where's that, like, big punch that I'm looking for?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, it's the big punch. Like, it's just not there. It felt, like, kind of scattered, like, hodgepodge together a little bit instead of, like, I don't know. And I feel like there was just some things that went on like longer, like some scenes that were like really longer and then better scenes that were shorter that should have been longer.
Yeah. It's just a little misshapen.
Yeah. Felt strange.
Cole Sprouse is cute in it though, as the zombie.
Yeah.
And I also liked the dream sequence. There's like a tribute to Voyage to the Moon.
Yeah.
That looks very like the old cool Smashing Pumpkins music video.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was really neat.
Cause like, I was going in expecting it to be like very Tim Burton-y, and it was more of like,
is,
in a way, like if Tim Burton did like a pop music video.
Right. The setting is Tim Burton. Like, it's his version of the suburbs where everything's very neatly right. put together.
But it's way, like, flashier and, like, more neon.
And girlier.
Which I really liked.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was good. I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Have you been watching anything?
Yeah, I saw a new horror movie as well.
Yeah?
That I think you might be interested in. I saw that movie Immaculate.
I want to see it. I knew you were going to say that because I'm like, that's like the big horror movie that's out there that people are very divisive about.
I mean, I think you like Sydney Sweeney, right? I remember you talking about Reality with her.
I liked Reality. I liked her in that... Was that Euphoria?
She's very good in that.
She's good in it, even though like Euphoria stresses me out so much.
I think this movie is worthy of her season 2 Euphoria performance, where it's just like all freak out at all 11 drama. All the time. Just
she's
like
so good
crying
at being
pure mascara every scene, you know?
Awesome.
This one builds to that. So like she plays this nun who shows up at this Italian convent and doesn't speak the language. And people are kind of like plotting behind her back because she can't really figure out what's going on. And then she wakes up pregnant one day and she's a virgin and she can't figure it out. She's like, everyone around her is telling her it's a miracle, but you get the sense that this is like some kind of Catholic death cult that she's been trapped inside.
Yeah.
So it veers into kind of that like forced pregnancy paranoia, which I know is a, kind of a pet topic for you. Like you like movies where other people are conspiring to make you have a baby.
Yeah.
Because that's creepy.
Right. It's like the ultimate like violation.
And yeah.
Like, first of all, I think pregnancy is scary.
Yeah.
But like pregnancy that you can't control and you don't know how you got it is probably scarier.
Yeah. It's at like Rosemary's Babies, a classic in that genre. What was the one we watched on Hulu that was like with Pierce Brosnan?
Oh, and Alana Glazer.
Yeah.
Oh, crap. I can't Whatever think of the called. Name of it. That was great.
So this movie, you kind of know what's going on before she does, because you've seen False Positive is what that was called.
Oh, but yeah.
You've seen movies in this ilk before, but like her performance in the third act is really why you want to show up. Like she really just hits the gas pedal to the floor when she like decides I'm escaping from this place. Speaking of another forced pregnancy one, kind of like Gwyneth Paltrow in the back half of Hush. When she's like trying to escape the house and it's like
in that old Jeep,
she's like violently fighting back with this like, you know, 9 month pregnant belly. And the way it ends is what makes the movie worth seeing. So like there are other recent movies like Barbarian, Malignant, The Boy. I'm thinking of movies that like seem very generic and it's like I've seen this 100 times
and then you
and
get
then
this,
the third act is like, okay, that was bonkers,
like
I'm glad
what
I
movie
out.
Are we in right,
right
now.
Yeah,
okay, I know what you're
so
saying.
So it's that kind of movie.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite as good as the other titles I just listed, but it's still worth seeing. Okay. for where it goes, I think.
Interesting, because so. Like I've heard, like, of course the marketing is like, this is the scariest movie of our decade, like it's gonna freak you out, and then people like kind of win, they were like, well, it wasn't that scary. And then I'm like, well, I mean, how scary a movie is, I don't think, like, makes it a good or a bad movie. Like, if you're going just for that scare factor. Like, there's some movies that scare the shit out of me that are fucking terrible, right?
Right.
But I still see it as being enjoyable. So
this one's got, like, jump scares and stuff. It makes you startled in your seat. But really, it's, like, just the audacity of, like, what it does with the material, you know?
Yeah.
Also, like, it made me like her more because it's something that she cared about a lot. Like...
Oh.
She auditioned to be in this movie a while ago, and she didn't get the part, and the movie didn't get made. So now that she has a little bit of clout, she put her name on it as a producer. She brought back this director she worked on this movie called The Voyeurs, which is like this erotic thriller she made a few years ago.
Oh, yeah. I like that a lot.
I like it, too.
Yeah.
So, like, she brought this project to completion herself. And right now, I mean, the past few weeks especially, there's been a lot of, like, focus on her body, and there's all these weird conservative pundits talking about her like gigantic breasts all the time, and like there's something about the material being about her being treated as this fertile vessel for baby making that like kind of connects with her public persona a little bit.
I didn't make that connection because like I have noticed like I've been getting a lot of like these videos like hitting my feeds on all, you know, on TikTok and Instagram and stuff where it's like, you know, big butts are out and Sydney Sweeney's bringing back
mommy
breast implants again. Yeah, like, okay, well, big boobs are in again. Right. How amazing. So I thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, that's really interesting. How wonderful.
Good for her.
Good for her. Yeah.
And since you did one old one and one new one, I'll do an old one as well.
Ooh.
I watched this movie called The Telephone Book from 1971.
Okay. I've been having this on a watch list. Is it like the cover is like an eggshell blue, like a yes. robin's egg blue yes. and like a face?
Yeah. Okay. It's like this woman's face, but her face is also a rotary dial and telephone phone. That has all this like psychedelic stuff blossoming yeah. out of it, like okay. a flower.
I've always was curious to what it's about, so I'm very excited.
It's
right now.
Fucking great. Like, I highly okay. recommend it. You should borrow the disc from me because I don't think it'll ever be streaming anywhere.
Oh my God.
Because it's semi-pornographic.
Oh no. Oh no.
Oh no. The Telephone Book, 1971, New York City, cheap filmmaking. Like,
oh, I love
just, like, no money.
I love dirt in New York as a background.
Yes. It's mostly set in apartments too. And it reminded me a lot of Daisies.
Okay.
The Vera Chitilova film.
Love that movie.
Where her apartment is so ridiculously over-decorated, where it's like very collagey and like kind of handmade reshaping the apartment with all these weird little objects, except it's all pornography instead of like a curio cabinet.
Wow.
And this woman, she's about 18 years old, and she gets a dirty phone call at the start of the movie from a stranger, and he's calling from a telephone booth, and she has like the best sexual experience of her young life listening to this man talk on the phone. And then he gives her a name that's very generic, like John Smith or something like that.
Ooh.
And he's like, well, I'm in the book. Look me up. So she starts going to every John Smith in the telephone book in New York City. And they're all dirty old men. And she's trying to find the one that called her on the phone. And you kind of think the whole movie is going to be like that, like kind of like a sketch comedy thing where there's just different Johns around the city that she's trying to like recreate this like sexual experience with. But instead, about halfway through, the actual guy shows up at her apartment wearing a pig mask and does this really long monologue that takes up most of the rest of the film about how he came to be so good at making dirty phone calls. And it's this insane, paranoid rant about America during the war and like space travel and like space psychosis and like the dissolution of the American family. And he talks about how he could like take down the government with dirty phone calls. That's how good he is at it. He could like seduce the president and his wife and his kids in one phone call. Like, it's absolutely nuts in the back half. It gets more and more psychedelic until the end where she gets him to call her again from a different phone booth. And we don't get to hear how good the phone call is. We just see her reaction to it with all these like hand-drawn pornographic cartoons doing like psychedelic sex stuff on the screen.
Wow.
It's nuts. It's a wild movie.
Wow.
So maybe we'll do something with that later. I don't know. It would be like a movie of the month or like a podcast topic or something.
It sounds like it's worth talking about more.
Yeah.
And in depth.
Every time y'all come over for movie night, I feel like I need to pull something like that out where it's like something wild, you know? If we sit down and watch Prince of Tides or
I know
Moonstruck, it's not quite the same thing, you know.
I know. I think like we've had some very bizarre like movie night movies.
The Suckling
Beast.
Oh, Beast. That's great.
God.
Yeah.
The Suckling Beast. What was that one where it was like the silent cinema one? It was like we were in a sensory deprivation tank together.
Oh yeah, it was a slow cinema thing. What was that called? I don't remember.
I don't remember either, but I remember it was like my first like introduction to slow cinema all on movie night.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's always a bizarre experience, but I don't know, maybe now that I have a place of my own,
yeah,
I'll bring in like that Lifetime like middle-aged woman taste in movie into movie night.
Right. That's what Studio C is for.
Studio C.
Well, today we're not doing extreme movie night like brain busters.
We're not.
No, we're doing comfort food movies.
Mm.
Both of them star Nick Cage.
Yeah.
As the dangerous boy that you fall in love with despite yourself.
Yeah, he's dangerous in both.
It's those crackly teeth. He might bite you with them.
I know. So sharp.
And all that's coming up to you right now.
Loretta, I love you. Not like they told you love is. And I didn't know this either. But love don't make things nice. It ruins everything. It breaks your heart. It makes things a mess. We aren't here to make things perfect. Snowflakes are perfect. stars are perfect. Not us. Not us. We are here to ruin ourselves and to break our hearts and love the wrong people and die. I mean that the storybooks are bullshit. Now I want you to come upstairs with me and get in my bed.
So I'm going to be very honest. This topic, all the topics that I was like trying to come up with were so we can watch this movie and talk about it.
Yeah.
And that movie is Moonstruck.
Well, what's funny about that to me is I never need an excuse to watch Moonstruck. like I throw this on all the time.
I feel like I'm always trying to get people to... No, I'm not always trying to get them. I talk about Moonstruck unprovoked a lot.
Yeah.
So this is great. Like, now there's a purpose for me to talk about it.
Okay, we've been doing this website for 10 years now-ish.
Oh my God,
by the end of this year. And generally, anything I watch at home, I try to come up with some reason to write about it or throw it on some list or it's like podcast topic or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I've probably seen Moonstruck about 5 or 6 times since we started Swampflix.
Yeah.
I've never touched it. Like, I guess it's just the kind of thing you don't even really think to pick apart.
I was kind of shocked that, like, I'm like, wait, didn't we have an episode where this was in it?
I couldn't find any.
I think
sample.
We just talk about it.
Yeah, it just comes up a lot.
So Moonstruck is quintessential Cher movie. I think, like, you know, Cher, like, you know, a few other folks, like Barbra Streisand, great singer, great actress. She dabbles in a little bit of everything when it comes to the arts. But this is the movie I think is like the most like Cher movie to exist. And then also one of the best like Nicolas Cage performances.
Yeah.
And who, like, if you would say that to someone who's like, I don't know what Moonstruck is. And you're like, well, it's sort of like the movie How Stella Got Her Groove Back, but it's Cher. And then like the hottie and the big, you know, bombshell performance is Nicolas Cage. They would go, what are you talking about? Like, you wouldn't think that Cher and Nick Cage would have chemistry at all, especially considering, like, this was, what, 88, this movie was made? And they have it. Like, there's something that's so, like, passionate about, like, all their interactions. And it makes me so gleeful. Like, so I guess I could talk a little bit about what this movie's about. So... Cher's character is Loretta. Loretta lives with her parents in New York. Anytime there's a film with like New York as a backdrop, it's the best. And I don't know, like New York is its own character in this movie.
Especially Italian New York.
Italian New York, oh yeah. My God. And well, Loretta is in a relationship with Johnny, and there's no like spark in their relationship, no razzle dazzle. It's very much like she's like, I need to marry this man. She had a very unfortunate marriage previously that ended up with her husband dying. And she like, she's very superstitious and connects everything to like luck and these little signs that come up. And it's like, well, if I do this at this time, then we get married and we get married in this way, then I'm going to have a successful life. So she kind of blames herself with how her previous husband passed away because of how they got married. They went to the court. They didn't have this big wedding. So now she's like, no, like you have like, Johnny, if you propose to me, you have to do it this way. We're going to get married this way. And this is going to change my look. And then Johnny is like, well, you know, my mother is dying in Palermo. I got to go to Palermo to be with my dying mother. I need you, Loretta, to go and find my estranged brother and get him to come to our wedding. So she's kind of like, oh, like, I didn't know you had a brother. And mind you, like, her appearance is very, like she has a streak of gray hair and it's supposed to, like, make her look older.
She's 37 years old. That's the character's 37.
But, like, you would think she was 50. By the way that she acts, like, she kind of walks in it like a frail old lady way. And she has, like, these shawls over her. She dresses like a maman.
She's, like, giving up, yeah.
Right.
I'm 38 years old. I do have that amount of gray hair. Like, it's, like
the Cher gray?
Yeah.
Hmm.
But they really like play it up in this. Like, she looks like she's like decrepit.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Like, she's about to go to the home.
Right.
So then she goes to this bakery to find Johnny's brother, Ronnie. And she goes out to like the basement of the bakery where all the bread is made. And she meets Ronnie. And Ronnie is Nicolas Cage.
One of the great scenes in the history of the art form.
Fabulous scene. Fabulous monologue where he basically says, you know, fuck Johnny. I lost my hand because of him. Because he wanted me to bake bread for his other wedding, and he turned, like, Johnny was talking to his brother Ronnie, and Ronnie took it, like, kind of took his attention away from what he was doing, and he lost his hand. And so he always blamed his brother for that, and they never talked. So then he does this great monologue where it's like, you know, at the same time, Ronnie was engaged to a woman who left him when he lost his hand. So he does this, you know, Johnny has his hand. Johnny has his bride. I lost my hand. I lost my bride. And he says something. You think I'm going to throw it away and forget?
I love him telling the cashier that's obviously in love with him to go fetch the bid knife. He's going to go slit his own throat.
I would kill myself. And she's like, no, I won't do it.
Yeah,
and
she's then crying.
She speaks up at the end where she's like, God, I love him so much, but I can't tell him because
everyone knows
broken.
You're in love with him. Your eyes are like leaking a hose of water.
And he's shoveling bread in this really hot basement. Yeah. He's sweating. It looks like he hasn't like bathed in weeks. His hair looks insane. Like he got electrocuted. His teeth are jacked up, but he is like the hottest thing in the world.
He's ripped too. Like the muscles showing through that.
The bread.
That undershirt.
This like really jacked up Nick Cage is shoveling bread into the oven, you know? Mm. But you could tell like, you know, Loretta's all like, I don't buy this bullshit. And she's like, let's go to your apartment and talk. Where do you live? And he's like, I live upstairs. And they go upstairs. And then the most like if you think that scene was good, it gets even better. So Ronnie has all this like pent up anger, and like Loretta like obviously thinks it's pretty hot. Why wouldn't she? It's amazing. And he brings her upstairs, and then they have this really like heated discussion that ends with him like taking his hand and just throwing everything off the table, throwing the table against the wall and like picking her up. And she's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm bringing you to the bed. Oh no. And they have this beautiful romantic night. And at the same time, like we have like these different characters that we're following. One is her father, who is having an affair with another woman, and her mother, Olympia Dukakis, who also, like, they make it seem like she's 80 in here, and she's totally not. Like,
stunningly beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
So she goes out to have dinner on her own while her husband is out, you know, quote unquote working or doing whatever. So she goes have her little Italian dinner, and there's a man at the table next to her where he's like with this younger woman, and they have an argument and she leaves, and then she ends up like having dinner with this man,
John Mahoney.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, she kind of has that temptation a little bit, but she doesn't act on it. And then they live with the like a 90-year-old grandpa who just like his love is his dogs. He has like
five or six dogs
that he brings on walks. He feeds them from the table. Like these little dogs have it made. So it's just like we're kind of following like Loretta's family. And all this kind of happens on a night where the moon looks like really beautiful. And her aunt and her uncle talk about like how there was one night where her uncle saw the moon. He's like, it was bigger than I ever seen before. And then I'll look outside and there's Cosmo, which is Loretta's father, and basically saying how like, oh, it's Cosmo's moon, like this big moon that like makes you like
fall in love.
Yeah. Moonstruck, hello.
Which seems to be tied to That's Amore, the Dean Martin song. Like there's something about those two things that are like connected.
The big pizza pie.
Yeah.
In your eyes, Amore, the moon.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's almost like the movie's like an adaptation of that song, but
yeah,
it's not
very direct,
but it's the very first thing you hear on the soundtrack.
Yeah. Oh God. I don't know, like, there's something about movies like Moonstruck. It reminded me a lot of, like, Big Night. Like, just these New York Italian movies that have, like, a lot of beautiful night scenes, a lot of beautiful Italian music and Italian food. It's so comforting. It's like, yeah. Oh, it feels like someone's wrapping me up in a little cannoli shell.
I will say what's indistinguishable to me is, like, Jewish population movies in that same vein.
Uh-huh.
They're exactly the same.
Oh,
like, there's
totally.
Something about, like... Yeah, like the Jewish New York subculture and the Italian New York subculture, where you could like swap the actors around. It wouldn't matter to me. Like,
I think it's just like they're very passionate cultures, very passionate family members that, you know,
they bicker lovingly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, so Loretta sort of has this makeover. Like, she goes to the hair salon and they do her nails and they fix her hair up. So, and of course this all happens after she sleeps with Ronnie. It's almost like she has this like pizzazz that's been missing from her life, and she goes and then all of a sudden she looks like a hot, you know, 30-something-year-old Cher.
Cher's here. Yeah.
Cher is here. And she dresses up and she goes to the opera with Ronnie. Because that's his thing. He's like, I just want you to go to the opera with me. Like, he falls in love with her instantly and tells her that. Like, I'm in love with you. The only other thing I love is the opera. So if I could just have you, this woman I love, with me at the opera, this thing that I love, I'll be done and I'm fine. And they have this beautiful moment at the opera house. I think it's at the Lincoln Center. And she continues to see him. And I don't know. It's just like this odd couple that works so well. Like, the chemistry that Loretta and Ronnie have is just this like beautiful thing that like, oh, people could only like dream of having.
So wait, why are they mismatched? Is it because she's very careful and like does the same thing every day and he's like a monster?
he's just unhinged. I think it's mixed match because he was way younger than her in this movie too.
Okay.
Like, I think there's an age gap, but I don't think that it is an age gap in the movie.
I know that she fought for him. Like, the studio wanted this other actor they screen tested, and she was like, no, it has to be Nikki, or I'm not doing it.
Oh my God, amazing.
So she recognized that chemistry while they were
But casting. Yeah, like, he's this, like you said, like this really gruff, like sweaty monster, yeah, of a man. And Loretta's very quiet, but also like they both are very, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. They're both strong-willed people. I think, yeah, that's like the thing they have in common. And they're both pretty passionate too, but Loretta's very much like, oh, this isn't right, I'm not gonna do this. And he's like, why not? Let's do this.
Yeah, he's like a lot more willing to blow up his life than she is.
Right. Like, she's like thinking about like how it's gonna impact. And then the big thing is her luck. Right.
Right.
Like how this is gonna intertwine with like this bad luck streak that she's been having and her superstition. Yeah.
The original screenplay title was The Bride and the Wolf, and they made the screenwriter change it because it sounded like a horror film.
Oh, but that beautiful, there's a great bit in here too of about like where she says, you're a wolf, Ronnie.
Yeah.
And basically tells him like, you're the reason you lost your hand is you're a wolf, you chewed your own arm off.
Oh my God, she's known him for like an hour when she says that to him. That's fucking crazy.
It's like they were meant to be together.
Yeah.
But like basically saying like, if you didn't lose your hand, you would still be in this relationship with someone who obviously didn't love you, because the fact that they left you when you lost your hand, it's like she tries to tell him like, you actually lucked out.
You dodged
out.
A bullet.
You,
yeah,
dodged a bullet there. But it's when she tells him that, like, he looks like a wolf a little bit, because he has like this very interesting, like, very, his chest hair is very Wolverine like
yeah,
and then he has these like big chops, and like his whole look is very wolf like even with his little hand, his little wooden hand.
Yeah. So okay, so I get he's the wolf because he's an animalistic monster. He's,
yeah,
he's pure passion, pure id.
Yeah.
And she's the bride because she knows that she has to be married again,
right,
before her like her life is over, because she's 37 and she's,
God,
looking down the barrel of, you know,
watching movies, death, like this just makes me be like, oh my God, should I be concerned about any of this?
Right, right. And I guess the only thing we haven't mentioned yet is after the opera segment and everyone's had their like flirts with infidelity, like every single person,
yeah,
has an infidelity crisis.
It's the moon.
Then the final sequence is about 20 minutes at the kitchen table. It's a very like classic Shakespearean farce where like every character from the movie that really matters to the plot shows up in the kitchen, except for John Mahoney. He doesn't make it, but every other person.
That'd be great though. It feels culminates. Like a play. Like,
yes,
I could see Moonstruck being like a really good, like stage play.
The guy who wrote it was a stage play writer in New York City. Okay. And like, this is one of his first screenplays that he wrote.
Yeah, that makes sense, though. I didn't know that. But yeah, the final 20 minutes when they're all in the kitchen, it just like it's some of these like really long shots where I don't know. I like it because you could tell that everyone was on their game. Like there's mm-hmm. not a lot of like cut here, cut here, cut here. It's just like long. It feels very theatrical. It's
very talky.
Yeah.
But it's funny that all these like storylines are all piling up all in the same spot.
Yeah.
There's something about how much use that kitchen gets where like there might be one scene at the formal dining room table, but the rest of the movie is all centered around this like kitchen.
Yeah.
So there's something about like everyone gathering there in a way that feels true to a specific kind of like domesticity. I want to say the stage play stuff comes out in the rest of the movie too, in that a lot of it feels very symbolic, especially Cosmo's moon. Like,
yeah,
there's something like poetic about that device and the fact that everyone's always mentioning the moon, and the moon's like just outside of every window shining this like beam of light into all their lives.
Yeah. And the way that every character, like even some of the minor ones, the way they deliver their lines, it feels like it's their little monologue over and over and over again, because they do it with like, they put their whole ass in it.
Yeah. Especially awesome. Nicolas Cage as Ronnie, because he has all these, God. Like, he's so in love with Loretta.
Yeah.
And every line is this, like, poetic, like, we're not meant to be perfect. The stars are perfect. Snowflakes are perfect. We're meant to tear each other apart. Love isn't nice. Love isn't clean. Like, everything he says is this, like, overthought, overpoetic thing that, like, has probably been cooking in his brain.
He's a Renaissance man.
Yeah, yeah. He's pure passion. He like doesn't know how to like act in polite society.
But I think like, so yeah, speaking of that, like how this movie does such a good job of like Nicolas Cage is like the man of the moment and the heartthrob.
Yeah.
Like it's less of like, well, I think it's his physical appearance and his physical actions, but it's the way that he talks, I think, that like makes him such a massive like hottie in this movie compared to his other heartthrob flicks. Like I don't know, I think it's more of like his tone and the way that he talks and then how he talks.
What I found odd when we did the full episode earlier was like it wasn't stuff like this and Wild at Heart that seemed weird to me. Like I get him as a heartthrob when it's like he's so overly passionate and animalistic.
Yeah.
And there's something like attractively over enthusiastic about him.
Mm-hmm.
What weirded me out more was It Could Happen to You, where he's just like a normal guy.
Just a nice cop.
Yeah. Like, what is that? Like, why would you cast him to be just an everyman? It's such a strange.
It's so crazy how, like, in It Could Happen to You, like, he's really good in that, too.
Yeah. But.
And he's so tame.
He's not given much to do, I guess. Yeah.
No.
It's like, you could hire anybody to play that role. Why would you hire Nick Cage for that, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they saw Moonstruck and they were like, that's it. And they're like, I don't know if he used to do all of that in this movie.
The director, Norman Jewison, said he, like, wanted Nick Cage for this movie originally because it was the most troubled man he knew. He's like, I needed an actor seems genuinely troubled.
Perfect for the role of Ronnie.
Yeah. I mean, you see it immediately. As soon as you go to that basement where you're shoveling bread in the hot hole in the wall, like, pretty convincing monstrous figure, you know?
Yeah. I just think that like Loretta is so hilarious, like the way that she reacts to all this stuff where you're like, where most women would be crying or being like, what the, oh my god, this is crazy, I'm leaving. She's like so drawn to it and like comical in her responses.
Yeah.
That it's so fucking funny.
She gets into the fantasy of it too, like when he's like ravishing her for the first time,
and she's like, "Oh God, oh no, oh what am I doing? Take me, leave me where it's just where I'm just skin and bones,
or something. Tear me apart,
tear me apart.
My God, pretty sexy to be honest.
So funny. Oh, but it's just, it's so hilarious how it's like, how did this woman who like, right, they dressed her up to like she was like 58, 60, right? And then she's with this guy who looks like he's about the same age. And then all of a sudden she just dyes her hair black and has like a little perm. And then she's, you know, 30 years younger with this monster of a wolf man. God, what a great film.
Father, is it your mother? Just let me talk to them. I can really fix
them. No, there's nothing to fix. It's not them. It's not them at all. It's me, okay? I can't see you anymore, okay?
Okay. Okay. I know what it is. I know what it is.
I know what this is. It's your fucking friends, right? Shit, Julie. I mean, what is this? It's between you and me, not between the rest of the fucking world. So fuck off. It's your friends.
Fuck you! Now fuck off for sure! Like, totally!
So I kind of get Nicolas Cage as the, like, voracious wolfman lover in Moonstruck. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But I still think he was at his cutest in Valley Girl from 1983.
Agreed.
He's absolutely adorable in this film. And it's kind of the same role. This is supposed to be a Romeo and Juliet style high school romance.
Yeah.
From people who are mismatched because they're from different social sects. One is this girl, Julie, I believe.
Yep.
Who is the titular Valley Girl. So she does that Clueless style Valley Girl speak where everything's totally whatever.
Yep.
Gnarly, or I'm trying to think of other words, bitchin', they say a lot. So this is like well before.
They talk like Ninja Turtles.
Clueless. But yeah, they created that language. Like, yeah. That was a subculture that had its own vernacular. It was popularized by Frank Zappa and his daughter. I want to say it was Moon Zappa, where he heard how his daughter and her friends were talking and was like, that is an insane list of like slang terms y'all have come up with. And it's very insular. And no one else talks like that. So he made this like novelty song where his daughter was just like chatting on top of him singing the words Valley Girl over and over again.
Cool.
Like, oh my god! Valley Girl! Like, totally! Valley Girl! And Cena was like, so bitchin'. Valley Girl! There's like the Galleria. Valley Girl! And like all these like really great shoe stores. I like love going into like clothing stores and stuff. I like buy the neatest mini skirts and stuff. It's like so bitchin' because like everybody's like super, super nice. It's like so bitchin'.
It's a very fun song. And then I think he was trying to develop a script and it eventually was just passed on. And he got kind of miffed later because it whatever he had started turned into this Martha Coolidge film from the early 80s. But so Julie is this stereotypical Cher Horowitz archetype.
Yes.
And she's getting kind of bored with her friends. Like, she's dated the same couple of guys over and over again. They're not particularly interested in her. Like, they just date because that's who they're supposed to be dating, you know? And then she goes to this house party that's crashed by Nicolas Cage and his doofus friend, who are from the big scary city of Hollywood.
Yeah, Hollywood boys.
And they're supposed to be Hollywood punks. But even though this is like early 80s in California, it's not like scary hardcore punk at all. It's like,
it's like new wave almost.
Yeah.
Let's put a blue streak in our hair.
Right.
And wear old pants.
And when they take the girls to like a Hollywood club to go watch this like scary band, it's not aggressive or anything like that. It's pop music with guitars instead of synthesizers. Which
it's like the Pismals or something, which was like a big band in that area at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like how like he's supposed to be like this grungy Hollywood guy. I think that they're... because of like how they what they were able to film on with like the low budget of this movie,
yeah,
like they just had to kind of do like shots of them driving through like Sunset Boulevard, looking at all the big places, and then like taking like the entrance of one club that looks kind of cool, but filming in another club that isn't as hardcore as that.
Yeah.
So it's like very like mix matched. So I don't know. Like part of me is like, maybe if there was more opportunity that the setting would look a little grittier.
And I think it would be unlikely that you would make a wide audience listen to Black Flag or the Circle Jerks or something like that. Like
that's true too.
You kind of need something a little more appeasing to get this movie like in every theater in the country, you know?
Right. It's like, it's the poppiest punk that's yeah. not pop punk that you will hear.
And he's the counterculture answer to her and her friends who, in the opening sequence of the movie, just drop hundreds of dollars on their daddy's credit cards at the mall.
Wild.
So, like, there is a lot of, like, bubbly shopping mall consumerism, very super neon 80s, and then the grittier Hollywood punk scene where people are wearing mohawks and, like, thrift store clothes and spiked collars right. and stuff like that.
There's no ruffles and lace yeah. over there like they have in the Valley.
And his monologues about how her and her friends are all fake and phony and like he's from the real world is very funny from someone who lives in Hollywood, which is like one of the fakest fucking cities on the planet.
Yeah.
But despite how much they talk shit about each other and like the worlds that they come from, every time they lock eyes, it's like everything else melts away. It doesn't matter. They just have like genuine chemistry. And literally that song, I'll Stop the World and Melt With You,
yeah.
will play for like minutes on end.
We hear it twice.
While there's like montages of them going on these like really cute dates around the city.
Yep.
And she can't fit him in her world. Everyone's rejecting his presence in her life, but she also can't deny the like genuine spark of attraction that they share.
I always find that to be like, I've seen this movie so many times.
Same.
Like, her parents are hippies, and they're very liberal, and they are very much, like, we're the oddball in the bunch, and I think it's, like, part of her is, like, that rebelliousness is her being ultra-conservative, and not, I mean, obviously, like, she fell in love with, like, Randy, you know, Hollywood boy, but it's almost like you would, like, I always thought, like, well, why wouldn't, like, you're raised in that environment where, like, y'all are different, so why not bring this, like, different guy in?
Yeah.
But I think it's almost this part of her that's, like, I don't want to do that because my rebellion would be to, like, not do that and to, like, bring over the guy that's, like, super conservative.
That would make her parents proud if she had, like, a rebel boyfriend.
Exactly. So yeah. I kind of looked at it as, like, her being rebellious a little bit, too.
I looked up her dad to make sure he wasn't Sonny Bono.
He looks like Sonny Bono, yeah.
I was like, did I forget that Sonny Bono's in this movie? He's not. But it would have been funny to have, like, a Sonny and Cher thing this episode.
Oh, God. It almost came together. Wouldn't that have been crazy? Well, we had a fake Sonny and a real Cher.
Yeah. And okay, so eventually their relationship blows up because she can't make room for him in her life.
Right.
And then it all ends at like the John Hughes prom sequence where he crashes the prom anyway. And
with
is like
Josie Cotton.
That is a crazy sequence. But
yeah.
So yeah, anyway, there's like a big fight with him and the prom king. And it ends in like a food fight. And then they run away together. But yeah, the prom is played by Josie Cotton. Whose novelty song Johnny Are You Queer is played full length in this movie.
Yep.
Strange for a movie where the boys like to yell homophobic slurs a lot, like every time they get into a fist fight.
That's who y'all picked to play at your Valley prom.
So strange.
And she's got like this metal choker on too. Like she looks like way more Hollywood than like Nick Cage and his friend look. I don't know. I thought it was kind of bizarre.
I think the Josie Cotton thing is like kind of a good middle ground between their two worlds, right?
Oh, yeah, because she does have like that Valley speak and kind of like her like voice and how she's kind of like poppy. And
who am I thinking of? That's not Cyndi Lauper, but had like Oh Mickey, You're So Fine.
Tony Basil.
Yeah, like there's something a little poppy in Tony Basil about her. Yeah,
that's true.
But yeah, I just love this movie. It makes me very happy. It's very simple. There's not a lot of stylistic flourishes, except right. that it's from a very specific era with a very specific style. You know, like the Valley Girls in their own subculture bring this kind of like ready-made cinematic style to the screen where it's like they already did all the work and all Martha Coolidge has to do is like point the cameras at them.
Yeah. I like how it serves like a time capsule of like that Valley Girl culture that, like, you hear about it, there's songs about it, you see, like, fashion and this and that, but this kind of brings all of it in to where I'm like, oh, that's what that was like. It's the speak, it's the way they dress, it's the... I always, like, crack up at, like, the party scene where the stepmom's making sushi, and then they're just, like, biting into it and, like, closing their eyes, like, oh, God, this is so good. which, actually, the sushi that they had was, they used peanut butter because they couldn't leave, like, raw fish
it
on
looks,
set all
it
day.
It looks so bad,
so too. I guess they're, like, this is supposed to be uni.
It looks like peanut butter on camera.
Yeah, well, that's what it was.
Another odd detail from that party is the kids are dancing their little, like, preppy dance while their collars popped.
Yes.
To Sparks's Angst in My Pants, which is more counterculture than any song Nicolas Cage listens to as, like, the punk, you know?
Right.
I just thought that was really
strange.
Odd.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's, like, flipped or if the people choosing the soundtrack were just, like, slightly off.
Or maybe that's, like, yeah, well, the kind of, that's, like, a similar thing with the Josie Cotton.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's, or maybe it's them being like, they want to be hard, but they can't be. So if they listen to the music, then they think they are.
There's something off. There's something more punk about what the Valley kids are listening to than what the Hollywood punks are listening to. Yeah, there's some kind of imbalance there. But yeah, you know, not revolutionary stuff. I think Clueless is the one that kind of perfected this movie, but I like this kind of rough prototype for it. I think there's something really... true and on the ground floor. Yeah. You know, like, this came out a good 10-12 years before that one.
Yeah.
And it really hits That's the true. Core of this, like, moment in time.
Yeah. I was thinking about, like, on this recent watch of it, how obsessive Nick Cage's character is whenever Julie turns him down and is like, she starts to, like, drift away from him purposely, where she's like, you don't fit into my life, my whole, like, my clique, so yeah. I need to, like, step away, and he, like,
stalks her.
But, like, the way that he does it, it doesn't feel predatory.
It's cute,
and you could tell that she, like, wants to be chased after. Like, it's almost like she needs that reassurance where she's confused, or she's like, I think this is what I need to do, is to not be with this person. But he's like, no, I love you too much to, like, let that happen, and I know that's why you're ignoring me, so I'm gonna, like, charm my way back into your heart. And it's almost like she, and of course, like, she has, like, the cutest smile ever. Like, she's got the, like, dimply smile.
Yeah.
And, like, every time he, like, pops up in some bizarre way, like, she kind of, like, smiles at him, where, like, she is kind of, like, enjoying,
well, yeah,
whatever it is that he's doing.
That's the whole basis of their relationship, is every time they, like, make eye contact, they both, like, beam. You know, they both get really happy.
Yeah.
And what's funny about that sequence is he keeps showing up in her life. Only she notices that he's doing it.
So,
and she never, like, pushes him away. It's like she just keeps getting happy to see him over and over again. And he's doing this undercover as basically, like, servant class. Like,
right.
He's, like, showing up as, like, the ticket taker at the movies, or, like, the waiter at the drive-thru.
Yeah.
And the other kids in her social circle just don't look at the help the way that she does.
Right. Or they're not noticing him, where it just goes to show you, like, how, like, entitled they are, that they didn't even make the connection. Oh, this is that guy that she's been fucking seeing, and he keeps showing up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something really adorable about that, when it could be, like, Revenge of the Nerds or something, where you go back and watch, you're like, oh, God.
Yeah, exactly. That felt gross. This one felt cute.
Yeah. And that's kind of the main selling point of the movie, is that it's super cute.
Yep.
It's got a great soundtrack. And I think Nicolas Cage has never looked more adorable. He just has...
He looks wonderful.
The sweetest, crackly smile.
He was, like, 19, I think, in this movie. He was still, like, technically a teenager.
He said this was not hard to act because he was, like, so in love with his co-star.
Yeah,
he's like, I genuinely
chemistry.
Had a huge crush on her, and I
Deborah
wasn't
Foreman.
Even really acting. I was just, like, staring at her and, like, was so giddy to be in her presence. And that comes through, I think, on,
like,
the
camera. I listened to, like, the commentary on this with the director, and she was saying how there was a lot of improvising that a lot of the characters did, but he did it, like, more so than anyone else. Like, she gave him, like, a lot of space to just kind of, like, act and, like, figure it out, because he hadn't really been in a lot of movies prior to this. Like, he was still pretty fresh.
Maybe Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and that's about all I can remember.
But she was talking about this in the commentary, and I thought it was funny, where she's like, there's this great scene where they're driving in Hollywood with the two girls in the car, and they're like shouting out at people on the street, and they're making noises and stuff like that. And they're like, oh, that was just them just making noises. And then they connected it with scenes later. And then she was like, it's just great how it all came together. And I'm like, I don't find it came together. Like, I find they both looked insane, where they were just like making weird howling noises. Would have been talking to people. Right. Like, it felt very unnatural, yeah. But it's hilarious the way it was done. I don't know. I don't hate it. I think it's cool.
The way it's rough around the edges definitely, I think, helps its charm a little bit. Like, if it had been a little slicker.
Yeah.
More corporate, you know? Like, yeah. This actually feels like people making something.
And it kind of was. Like, they, half of, like, the outfits that they wore, like, a lot of times, like, girls just, like, bring whatever you have in your closet that, like, looks like lingerie,
yeah,
or looks like something you wear to a party. And then they were able to like get some sort of boutique to like supply the fancier like prom dress type nice. stuff. Like, it's very like, it has a very like DIY feel to something that also feels big studio. And then I'm like, do I just see that because I grew up with this being like a massive movie, but like in its time was it more of like a not so massive movie, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Is this more like low budget, like indie side versus like a mainstream film?
I want to say this is like below the John Hughes stuff. Like, I would say probably Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club. Like, those I think were like bigger hits maybe. Yeah. And this is one of the things that just kind of stuck with people, especially VHS rewatches over the years. Like, this kind of like gradually got its tendrils in the culture a little more than
I used to watch this a bunch when I was like 15 and 16. Like, me and my friend would have like a lot of movie nights, and this was like always like one of our like favorite ones to watch. And I think it's like, I don't think it's just like the it felt like authentic, but also like it didn't take itself seriously, so it was also funny.
Okay, the first scene that Nicolas Cage shows up in this movie, they're on the beach, right?
Yes.
And he emerges from the water, and they go, he's so hot. Look at his bod. Like, they're, like, lusting after him.
Right.
Can you remember at those sleepovers if, like, he was, like, a hunk the way that, like, Patrick Swayze would be?
Yeah.
Crazy.
I remember we were like, oh, my God, why don't boys look like this?
That's so weird to think of now. Like, that's not his reputation at all anymore.
I know. And there's something cool about him, like not to bring it up again, but like his funky teeth being ripped. Like, he had these like subtle imperfections that I think like we all thought like, oh God, that makes him so hot.
He's like a bad boy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's like looking at him now, it's strange to reflect back on like his Randy days.
What is he now? Now he's just like your weird uncle.
Right. You know?
Who was like a little too into like goth music, but is like way out of touch with the culture now.
Right.
You know,
he was sort of like normal, basic, and then got really, really weird. And then now he's sort of getting back to like being like a less of a crazy, unhinged actor and human being to like being the old uncle, you know?
And the thing that like made him more famous recently was him just yelling random stuff or like making strange, violent choices that maybe deviated from the script. Like that whooping that he does in Valley Girl, you couldn't write that down. That's just something that's like a Nick Cage-ism, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's funny how those things are still super present in both of these movies. Like, there are things that he shouts in Moonstruck that are genuinely insane acting choices, especially during the Johnny has his hand, Johnny has his bride speech. Like, he really goes off the rails.
Yeah.
And there was a time where that kind of volatility was considered like hot and passionate. And now it's like kind of a meme.
Yeah. But I hate how that happened.
He was always good. You know, I think he's good now. He was great then.
I mean, honest to God, like, you know, hand up and everything, that monologue with him in the basement of the bakery that you were just talking about is like one of the best things that have ever graced the screen.
Totally agree.
Awesome. Yeah. If I could think of like, what are your top five favorite scenes in any movie anywhere, like that would be in it.
And now people cast him to do that in these like goofy monster movies where he fights like animatronic teddy bears or whatever. And
yeah,
the passion is still there. The erratic choices are still there, but it's like he could be making Oscar level drama still if they gave him a chance. You know?
He's a great actor. Oh my God. Could you imagine if we had like a Moonstruck revival with him and Cher as like Loretta like and sequel? Ronnie now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be weird?
Like My Big Fat Greek Vacation or whatever. they go to Italy.
They go to Italy.
Okay, pretty clearly, Moonstruck, one of the greatest films of all time. Valley Girl, not necessarily that, but I love it almost just as much.
I think it's like one of the better of like 80s pop culture movies.
Yeah, it's more on the level of like Mannequin than on the level of Moonstruck, but it's still very good.
Yeah.
I'm glad we did this. I have nothing to say about these movies other than I love them both very much.
Yeah. They're wonderful.
Yeah.